This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review. It's actually been 3 weeks since our last program of this type. We have a lot to cover today. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Anthony Chibatterwe.
Hello.
Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer, who is usually in the UK, but is here in the office with us today.
Great to be here.
For our lead story, we're going to bring you up to speed with events in Syria. In a lot of ways, this situation is at the heart of the major events of the day. Civil war there has been going on for several years. There have been somewhere around 200,000 deaths. And this has really been the main cause for the refugee crisis that has been rocking Europe. More than 5 million Syrians have fled the country. Most recently, Russia has intervened in this nation. It's sending a lot of military support into Syria, and there are some conflicting accounts of just what it's doing there. This whole situation has a lot of important implications, prophetically significant implications. So to give us the latest news about what's been happening there, we're going to turn to Brent.
Okay, now we're going to just focus mainly on what Russia's been doing inside Syria for the past week and a half now. They've started their, they're very open with their mission of what they're trying to do. They're saying that they're after the Islamic State to try and destroy them. But the facts on the ground seem to indicate that they're not just after the Islamic State, but what it's looking like is that they are supporting the Syrian regime in the other enemies of the Syrian regime, fighting against them. And they are the Free Syrian Army, different groups that are fighting against both Assad and the Islamic State. Now, this is, if you look at where the airstrikes of Russia have landed, they're not in the areas that you would expect them to take out if they were going after the Islamic State. The Islamic State controls a lot of the eastern portions of Syria. And the main fighting that you have right now, or the main airstrikes from Russia, they're taking place on that borderland that we've talked about before, closer towards the Mediterranean coast, right on this border where you've got the moderate or the rebels fighting against the Syrian army. That's where Russia's airstrikes are happening. So we know that the United States has been trying to fight the Islamic State for about a year now. And what we've also seen is that the United States has not come into open conflict with Russia, but Russia is kind of leaving the fight of the Islamic State to the United States while it takes out the ground forces that the United States is actually backing. I saw a video yesterday from Syria the same day, and it was of an American-made anti-tank missile fired by a Syrian rebel. The CIA gave these rebels this weaponry, and it was firing against a tank that belonged to Assad's forces, the Syrian president, and it's a Russian-made tank. And so you've got this...
Certainly deeply conflicting interests.
Deeply conflicting interests. And this is big news for the United States. They've spent a lot of money over the past year trying to defeat the Islamic State. Now, Russia comes in there kind of painting itself as the hero, but they're not taking care of the Islamic State right now. They're wishing to bolster and support Assad, their ally over there in Syria.
Something that we've talked about here quite a bit over the last month is just how strong Russia's interests are in Syria.
Right. I mean, they haven't... When you look at the terms in terms of what they've contributed so far, they have got a lot of bang for their buck. They might have a brigade size force in Syria right now, but they haven't really, you know, there's not big infantry that we can tell and definitely confirm. There's no Russian infantry on the ground inside Syria. Yet what you've seen is just rapturous support for Russia from Iran, from Syria, from different parts in Lebanon as well, for their involvement. Because at least finally somebody is getting serious, apparently, according to them, against the fight against the Islamic State. Now, so far, or as of yesterday, only 10% of Russian targets have been the Islamic State. So 90% of the fighting of the Russians has been against Assad's enemies that are not the Islamic State. Now, this past week did see it was surprising to me, maybe not surprising to other people, but a big uptick in the danger and the volatility of the region, because this was the first time that in the conflict so far that cruise missiles were shot from sea into Syria. Russia did this from the Caspian Sea, so all the way on the other side of Turkey, and they had to travel through Iran, had to travel through Iraq, went around the Kurds, and landed a full 1,200 kilometers away inside Syria. Now, cruise missiles, they pack a huge punch. There was, I think, 28 of them that landed in Syria. Four of them, it looks like they may have landed in Iran accidentally. But this is kind of a big move by Russia. They didn't have to use fire cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea, but they kind of wanted to show everybody in the region that we're the new player in town. The United States is in here. Those cruise missiles can go up to 2,500 kilometers, can reach anywhere in the Persian Gulf. Watch out, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. You're in reach of us as well, and we're not afraid to use this technology, this weaponry. So Russia is really picking up its game inside Syria, and I think they're doing it to accomplish more than just bolstering their ally, because we know that, you know, Assad was in a pretty precarious position to continue to be the ruler of Syria, but Russia's ambition is greater than Syria.
Well, let's talk about that. It seems like essentially since the last time we spoke about this, what you've seen is a major escalation by Russia, a major... not necessarily a gamble, but basically Putin recognizing the fact that the United States is not going to do anything about that. And even Europe, their response has been very timid to Russia's increased aggression there. And he feels like he basically has a free hand. And so this is what he's choosing to do. And it's almost daring the United States to stop him. So two things that I think are interesting that maybe we could talk about a little bit are, one, just how weak the United States is. I mean, there have even been some comments from American leaders that seem to kind of suggest that Russia is actually aligning with American interests.
Yeah, there's actually, I read a report, I don't know whether it's a conspiracy or not, but they were talking about how that Russia and the United States, they might actually be colluding together. I don't think that they are, but when you look at, if you're a Syrian Sunni that is fighting against the Islamic State and you're fighting against the Syrian army, what would you say? You see the United States taking out the Islamic State and then Russia taking out, you know, your guys as well. I mean, it looks like they're, even if they're not working in tandem, as far as their designs go, the results and the fruits on the ground look like that.
That in terms of keeping Assad in power.
Right, keeping Assad in power. A month ago, Mr. Kerry, the Secretary of State, he's weakened from the position that America has held for the past 4 years, that Assad must go. Assad right. cannot be part of the government in the new Syria. And a month ago he said that, well, the time frame on that is negotiable.
Well, there definitely is a visible reticence on the part of the United States to point too strong of an accusative finger against Russia. Like we recognize, or U.S. leaders recognize, we're not interested in picking a fight with Putin. And that's what Putin seems to be very cognizant of that fact.
Yeah, I'd like to read something from Brett Stevens. He wrote this week in the Wall Street Journal. He says, for a relatively trivial investment of some jet fighters and a brigade-sized support force, Moscow extends its influence into the Eastern Mediterranean, deepens a commercially and strategically productive alliance with Iran, humiliates the U.S., boosts Putin's popularity at home, and earns a geopolitical card he can play in any number of negotiations, Ukraine, got gas contracts, what have you. He's buying up his... He's getting a lot of chips when he puts his forces there in Syria. There's a lot that the United States has to go up against. They do not want to push Putin too far at all.
A really good summary of what Russia has to gain from this whole situation. So I'd like to go ahead and transition right over into Asia. And Anthony Chibadewe is filling in today for Jeremiah Jacques. The top Asia story ties right in with what we're talking about with Syria. Can you tell us about that, Anthony?
We were just talking about Russia's involvement in Syria. Now, guess who's joining Russia in Syria? Well, of course, it is Russia's biggest ally, China. This article that I have is from Tuesday, and it notes that there are numerous reports that indicate China's direct support and involvement of the Russians in this war in Syria. And this article, it quotes the Israeli military and intelligence news agency Debka file, which said that the Chinese have these Shenyang J-15 warplanes that are taken off from this aircraft carrier, which they had on the Syrian shores since September the 26th. So the Chinese already have aircraft carriers close to Syria, and they are launching warplanes to help the Russians in Syria.
Well, it is interesting with Russia doing something so clearly contrary to American interests, even though it might be spinning it differently and saying, well, we are attacking the Islamic State after all. Nobody should really have that big of a problem with it. They are undermining America's interests, and it is something that clearly would be of deep concern to America's leaders if they're really paying attention to what's going on there. But they're not. They're not concerned about that. I mean, China is not concerned about America's response to this. They are backing the nation that they've just been continually deepening their relationship with in so many ways. This is a really interesting advancement of that alliance that we've been expecting for all along between Russia and China. And in a military theater that we've never seen them collaborate on before.
The last time Russia was in the news was, or was dominating the news, was when it invaded Crimea. And now we have Russia in Syria. This is a very big development. The world, when it thinks about Russia, it's thinking about what it's doing in Syria. And now this is very symbolic. You now see China helping the Russians in this theater. So this is a very symbolic development. And the article goes on to mention what they've been talking about. This is from ValueWalk. It says that they've reported in August that there are indications of the emergence of the world's new superpower axis between Russia and China. And like you said, this is exactly what we have been talking about. We have a booklet about it, Russia and China in Prophecy. And this article also goes on to say, to indicate that this could be a prelude to a world war, really, because here you see Russia, it's pretty much doing its own thing. The United States cannot coordinate their efforts with the Russians in Syria. And already there is tension there. The United States cannot seem to get through to the Russians, and now they have the Chinese helping them. So they just wonder, when is this going to end? How is this going to end?
Well, the fact that it's a prelude to world war is amplified all the more when you consider how much the Syrian crisis is causing the refugee crisis and really creating a crisis in Europe on a scale that we have not seen before within Europe. Europe is being provoked dramatically by what's going on down there. I would imagine that Russian airstrikes in Syria are going to increase the number of refugees coming out of Syria. It would put more pressure on European nations in having to deal with that crisis. So there's just so many factors at play here that are very, very important for us to keep our eyes on. Well, thanks for that, Anthony. Before we move on to other Middle Eastern news, I'd like to just give you the opportunity to give us the overview of headlines from Asia.
Okay, we have an article from Reuters that talks about the Iraqis leaning towards the Russians, even in their war against the Islamic State. They're seeing Russia developing more, getting more involved, and they are seeking their request for airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq.
Are the Iraqis paying attention to the fact that the Russians aren't really bombing the Islamic State?
They should read the news a lot more. And then there's an article about the typhoon that hit China and killed 19 people, and at least four others are missing.
Okay, well, thank you, Anthony. You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to turn now to the Middle East. We've kind of been in the Middle East, but we're going to start with an overview of other headlines from this week, and we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, it was hard to just get distracted too much from what was going on in Syria, but I found a couple of stories. One was Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah there. He came out and said that he's going to ban all negotiations with the United States. He obviously doesn't like the United States one bit, but he doesn't want American culture influencing his nation. So he's put out a religious decision that they're not going to negotiate further with the United States, which is interesting because that was the whole point of the Iran deal, at least from the terms of what President Obama was going for, in that this would open up dialogue between the two states. In more positive news, or it could be seen in this way, the president of Egypt, Sisi, he called on Arab countries to expand their peace with Israel. Egypt's had a peace agreement with Israel for the past 40 years, signed by Anwar Sadat back in the late 70s, and he's kind of picked up the mantle from Sadat, and he's asking right now for other Arab nations to come on and sign that same peace treaty that he signed, or that Egypt signed years ago. It's really, really a courageous move when you think about it, given that the signing of that treaty is what eventuated into the death, the assassination of Sadat in Egypt. So now you have a new Egyptian leader saying the same thing.
Very interesting. And your top story from the Middle East?
Well, it was really quite sobering to look at what's happening in Israel of late, even right now. We didn't want to put a story about this into the Trumpet Weekly until Friday, just because there was just still a lot going on in and about Jerusalem, and then all the way in Israel proper, all the way up and down the state. You've had a lot of knife attacks that are taking place by Palestinians on Israeli citizens. A lot of rock throwing. Some people are calling it maybe the next intifada or the next uprising against the Jewish state.
How many is that now? It's been
technically it would be the third one. The first one was mainly a rock throwing intifada that took place in the early 90s. And then from 2000 to 2005, you had a lot of the bus explosions, mm-hmm. the suicide bombers that we remember. And that was the second intifada. And they've been throwing around this term for the past year because there has been an uptick in violence with the different ramming of vehicles into pedestrians all through Israel. But now it seems that it's mainly vicious stabbings. Now, they don't. It doesn't matter if they're a Palestinian woman or even a teenage boy. It's hard to spot these terrorists. And Israel is very sobered by this. There was an emergency meeting, a press conference that was given by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And while he tried to paint a hopeful picture, it was hard for him to do so because he says there are some measures that they're going to put in place to try and stop this. But what do you do? There's been three or more knife attacks throughout Israel every day for the past several days. And how do you stop that? They've tried to put in metal detectors throughout Jerusalem and get people to walk through them often. They banned all Palestinians from entering the old city of Jerusalem, apart from people that live there or shopkeepers, that type of thing, to try and just stop what's going on. Now, the Prime Minister says he has other ways of stopping this, but people aren't so sure. They're worried. Very much so. This is an article, the article that will go into the Trumpet Weekly. It's from today, and it's called Israel and the Palestinians Slide Deeper into Conflict. And this is by Avi Isakharov, and it's from the Times of Israel. And he says the upsurge of these kinds of attacks, that is the knife attacks and such, or the screwdriver attacks, or the potato peeler attack, which was today, anything that they can get their hand on, they were willing to use. The upsurge of these kind of attacks is all the more disquieting, given that the overwhelming majority of them are not organized by a terror group or known orchestrator, but rather are carried out by lone wolf terrorists. Now, we have talked about this idea of the lone wolf, and that probably might be incited by larger terrorist groups before, but it really doesn't seem that way right now. You have Palestinian leadership, yes, inciting violence, but there's no Palestinian group saying, okay, you go and do this there, you do that there. If you look at where these attacks have taken place, yes, some have been around Jerusalem, but others all the way in the north of Israel. A random guy with a screwdriver attacking an army personnel just walking around on his phone, Israeli army man. Things like that. I mean, people are watching their back. This is what he continues to say in the Times of Israel. He said, even without these kinds of bombings, talking about the way it was before, the relentless daily attacks are sowing fear and deep disquiet among Israelis. This is a kind of assault not previously encountered. Now, there's another article in the Times of Israel that talks about Israelis buying up pepper spray. I mean, there's this shopkeeper that said he sold 3 weeks' worth of pepper spray in a single day. That's in Tel Aviv. There's been attacks in Tel Aviv as well. And then the article continues to say, on Wednesday evening, Josh Carr, an immigrant from South Africa and former commander at the Israeli Defense Forces Krav Maga Instructor School, that's their martial art that they teach their soldiers, posted the following message in the secret Tel Aviv Facebook group, which caters to new immigrants and tourists. And this was the message that he wrote. He's in Tel Aviv. He says, dear friends in Israel, due to the current situation, I am offering a free self-defense course. The course will focus mainly on knife defense, but will include basic fighting skills and how to react in emergency situations. This will not turn you into a superhero, however, it could save your life or save the life of someone else. He was expecting a few people to sign up. He'll do some lessons in the park. He had 1,000 people sign up because they realize that they're in danger. And there's nothing. How do you prepare for something like this? There's pepper spray being bought. There's people doing, learning how to defend against knife attacks. There's another guy, Avi Schneider. He teaches martial arts in Bet Shemesh, just outside Jerusalem. And this article talks about how he's advising people to be aware of their surroundings. And he says, quote, don't be on the phone while you're commuting on train platforms. Stand with your back against a wall and not in the middle of the platform. Actually stake out the crowd. Look at each person and size them up. Judge them harshly as possible. Mm-hmm. This isn't like training for military men or people in the CIA. This is
how to live in
Jerusalem and Israel.
Yeah.
This is the degree to which it's got right now.
Well, we've really emphasized over the years just how much Jerusalem is really a thermometer of world events, that when things heat up there, that you're really looking at the possibility or the probability of things heating up elsewhere. And it's really kind of the touch point of so many end-time biblical prophecies, that when violence extends there and the Palestinian-Israeli situation heats up to this kind of violence that we see. I mean, we talk about Zechariah 14 as being basically a catalyst for a whole sequence of end-time events. And when that happens exactly, you know, you could see it exploding in a very, very short amount of time.
Oh, yeah, it's very troubling. As far as if you're an Israeli walking down the street, I mean, you're watching your back a lot. Netanyahu had a mother, who was asked a question by a reporter yesterday. What would you tell a mother in Israel right now about the security situation? He said, well, I'd tell them to be cautious and we're doing what we can. You know, do you let your kids go and play outside when these attackers don't care whether you're a military man or if you're a woman? Or a 14-year-old got hit today with a knife attack. So it is, you know, while it's incredibly, it is very sobering, and as it should be, but we have been watching for things like this to, as you say, to increase in Jerusalem. And that part of it, we know, is a sign of positive things to come. So we'll see what the Israelis try to do to stop it. Really, things like this, they can get out of control, and there's not much that they can do, it seems.
The articles that we're talking about here are in the Trumpet Weekly. This is a weekly report that we produce each week at thetrumpet.com with the most significant stories, the best commentary from the best sources that we can find. I encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you just go online to thetrumpet.com, you can become a subscriber to The Trumpet Weekly. Coming up next, we'll look at important news from Europe and America, and later on, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We're going to look now at Europe, and we have the privilege of seeing Richard Palmer in the flesh in our Edmonds studio. Richard, you're so much more handsome than I remember. Can you give us the overview of some of the important European headlines?
Thank you very much. Yes, the first one I'll talk about is François Hollande and Angela Merkel gave a very rare joint appearance to the European Parliament, where they pushed very strongly for a European federal state. So François Hollande, he said, we need to keep our eyes on the long term for the Federation of Nation States, which must remain on the horizon. He called for a common defense policy, shared asylum system, a European Coast Guard, new Eurozone institutions. And he had a very direct clash with UKIP's Nigel Farage, who wants Britain out of the European Union. And he basically said, if you don't want all of these big European superstate type institutions, then just get out of here. He said, I heard what Mr. Farage said. So the only road for those who are not convinced of Europe is to leave Europe. So it was a fairly dramatic clash there. In a similar vein, the European Central Bank President Mario Draghi, he said that Europe will not rest until monetary union is complete. So we have one of the top officials in Europe's monetary system, in the European Central Bank, making similar statements. And then finally, seeing as we've talked about Syria, I'll just touch on Europe's response to Syria. The United States has been telling Europe, look, we don't want you to deal with Russia about what's going on in Syria. We'd prefer it if you didn't get involved at all in Syria. Europe has just about completely ignored that. And so the various European leaders have been making statements. For example, Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, he said that Europe should accept Russia's role in Syria. And then last Friday, a week ago, Europe held a meeting with Vladimir Putin about Ukraine. America specifically said that Europe, that they did not want any discussions about Syria when Ukraine was on the table. Europe ignored that. Stratfor writes the Europeans have not read from the US script, and that they said that they are talking about the future of Syria. That Russia is talking about the future of Syria with France and Germany while the United States grinds its teeth. So that's another way that the United States is being proved impotent over Syria.
Very interesting. And your top story from Europe this week?
My top story from Europe this week is just the dramatic turnaround in Germany's approach to immigration. So a few weeks ago, we talked a lot how Germany was actually welcoming a lot of immigrants. And we did talk on this program about how quite a bit of that was overblown and how that there was a strong opposition. But really, I've been very surprised just how quickly Germany's acceptance of immigrants has turned around. So there was still a clear majority in favor of immigrants coming in. That has changed. So 59% now say that Germany was wrong to open the doors to new immigrants. Just 2 weeks ago, 57% of Germans said that they could manage all these extra immigrants. Now, only 45% say that they can manage these extra immigrants, and the majority, 51%, say that they can't. That's just 2 weeks. Now, Mr. McDonald on this program, he was talking about how, okay, yes, a lot of Germans may be pro-immigrant now, but once the reality sets in and once the costs of that and the implications of that decision become clear, that will turn. I know personally I thought that was something that it would take several months for those implications to set in.
Or maybe a terrorist attack or something like that.
Right, yes, exactly. But all it's taken is 2 weeks, and it's turned around. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who's so strongly embraced the immigrants, her popularity is down 9% in just a month. It's still fairly high. It's at 54%. She's a very popular lady over there due to her handling of the euro crisis, etc. But that's still the lowest level since 2011. So a big change in Germany.
And it's her handling of the immigration crisis that has precipitated that change exclusively.
Right. That's about the only thing that does seem to be behind it. It's been the big thing in the news. And it's the politicians that have been against the immigration. They've seen their popularity rise.
Mm-hmm.
So everything does point to being that is exactly the cause of that. And that actually brings me on to the other thing that I'd like to talk about here, which is the politicians that are in favor of this, of clamping down on immigration, who have been opposing Angela Merkel. Now, her main political opposition, she's center-right. The center-left aren't going to oppose her on this because they tend to be pro-immigration as well. But instead, a lot of that opposition is coming from her conservative allies, the CSU, those Bavarian conservatives. And so we've got an article in the Trumpet Weekly talking about how Horst Seehofer, who's currently the top leader in the Conservative Social Union, he has been very against immigration. He's been opposing Merkel. And the CSU invited Viktor Orban, who is the big bad guy for those that want immigrants. They invited him to come and speak at one of their big major conferences. And another individual who's been very outspoken, opposing immigration, chatting to Viktor Orban, has been Edmund Stoiber. He's a CSU veteran. He's not, he's you know, like a party grandfatherly type figure, very, very influential. And he's been critical of Merkel's statement saying that Islam is a part of Germany and is a religion of Germany. And he's also been speaking out against immigration. And then that leads us to another politician who's closely connected to both those individuals. And that is Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He was very much a protege of Stoiber. And Horst Seehofer, for the past few years, this other person who's been anti-immigration, he spent the past 3 or 4 years trying to get zu Guttenberg back into politics, back involved with the CSU. And this month, finally, he succeeded. He's taken up, it's still a relatively minor post, but my guess is he's getting in there, he's testing the water, he's dipping his toe in, and he's just seeing, is there a big backlash? Is there a big outcry of support? Which way is the wind blowing? But he's getting involved in advising the CSU and advising Horst Seehofer and their platform for the next election. So he's getting back involved. And the thing I think that's really interesting about this is that this article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly about the immigration, it concludes by saying that that Seehofer could perhaps demonstrate that Bavaria needs a strong leader to deal with this immigration crisis. And that's a sentiment that is coming from right across Germany and within this CSU party, within this anti-immigrant party. We're seeing zu Guttenberg slowly make a comeback, and we could, or Mr. Flurry recently talked about how this immigration crisis would lead Germans to seek that strong leader. And so at the same time as Germans are realizing this, we're seeing zu Guttenberg getting back into politics, and we're seeing him strongly connected with those anti-immigration politicians.
Watching this develop politically within Germany, it's absolutely not difficult to see how easy it would be for the immigration crisis to precipitate the rise of somebody who would fit more of that kind of a traditional German strongman position, who would take more power, who would say, you know, in order to deal with this, we have to take emergency measures, we have to be stronger and stricter, and we can't kind of do things, we can't follow the status quo. It's easy to see how that could develop.
especially as if this is where we are after 2 weeks, you know, where are we going to be after 2 months, after a year? And the Economist, I just have a quote from there, they said that Angela Merkel's altruistic embrace has caused a backlash that could weaken a chancellor that has so far been considered all but invincible. So this is, there is definitely something big brewing here in Germany.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. You're listening to our Week in Review program, and we're going to turn now to Anglo-America. Usually we would go to Robert Morley, but I'm going to do the honors myself this week. First, an overview of news items. This past week, massive flooding hit the Carolinas. It killed more than a dozen people and caused over $1 billion in damages. North Carolina received 5.2 trillion gallons of rain. South Carolina received 5.8 trillion gallons, according to an estimate by Weatherbell meteorologist. And USA Today on October 7th said that 11 trillion gallons is enough to end the drought in California, according to NASA calculations last December. Obviously, California wouldn't want to get 11 trillion gallons in a few days' time. That's not necessarily the best way to try to end a drought. But it was really remarkable just reading that USA Today article, which is in the Trumpet Weekly, just reminding me of the prophecy in Amos 4 and verse 7 about rain on one city and drought on another being one of the curses that we would suffer in this end time in the United States. Also, America's trade deficit ballooned to $48.3 billion in August, according to the Department of Commerce. The core imports rose 2.6%, mostly driven by consumer goods. And that means that so far this year, the trade deficit for the United States has increased 5.2%, $17.6 billion for this year. This is just money that is flowing out of the United States into other countries. A Business Insider article that we have in this Trumpet Weekly quoted one economist saying that this is going to be a significant drag on the GDP of the United States, and it will have far-reaching economic implications. The top Anglo-America story that I wanted to talk about is the Pope's visit to the United States. I realize this is a little bit old news now. It happened last week, but I feel like we have to talk about this. I was watching CNN and MSNBC and Fox News as the Pope was in the United States, and it was just wall-to-wall 24-hour Pope coverage. I have never seen anything like the way that the Pope was being covered by all of these media outlets that were just openly adoring everything about this man. It was amazing to watch everything that he did. It was so meaningful and so profound, and this man is so sincere. He's so special, so much love for the people. He has so much spiritual depth, and you know, they were analyzing his thoughts when he would pause for a moment and just look at someone. They knew what he was thinking, and it was just an extraordinary gesture. Every little gesture that he did, if it wasn't the reporters themselves on these channels, it was the commentators that they invited onto these stations who were talking about this, just openly adoring everything that he did. And it was particularly bizarre when there are so many areas right now where religion is under attack in the United States. This is the same CNN that likes to ambush pizza store owners and ask them about catering same-sex weddings. I mean, nobody asked the Pope what his views were on same-sex weddings. But as I was watching this, I was thinking, it really just seemed like I've never seen coverage of a religious leader the way that they covered the Pope. But it actually reminded me of the coverage that Barack Obama received when he first ran for president. You know, when you had Chris Matthews talking about the thrill in his leg that he got by listening to Barack Obama speak and so on. But it is not just reporting. This is not the press reporting on what's going on. This is them openly enforcing or openly advocating a particular point of view, and people were watching this and just going along with it. And it was amazing. And when the Pope was finished and he went back home, the surveys afterwards showed that a major boost in the Pope's popularity ratings, in the Catholic Church's popularity ratings in the United States. Overall, 20% of U.S. adults said they had a more positive view of the Catholic Church because of Francis. And I would say, you know, the press coverage had no small part in that. But this, among liberals, the shift was even more pronounced. 39% said that they have a more positive view of the church compared to 22% of conservatives. And I think it's not hard to see why that would be the case, considering the liberal positions that the Pope has taken on several issues, including very notably immigrant rights and the climate change debate and trying to combat climate change. But it really struck me how much the profile of this office, the Pope's office, has risen in recent years. It really wasn't that long ago that Americans were concerned about the possibility of electing John F. Kennedy president because he was Catholic, because they were afraid that, well, if he becomes president, he might prioritize Catholic interests over those of the United States. And we've come a long way since then. Mostly, I would say, probably starting with John Paul II. But in the time since then, it seems like, you know, it's prepared the way for what we saw on television last week. I was reading a Time magazine article about the Pope's involvement in the rapprochement between the United States and Cuba. It was talking about how the Pope sent a letter to President Obama urging him to make this deal. And lo and behold, President Obama did it. He made that deal. Now, the way that it's covered in that Time article, this is like a wonderful thing. I mean, the way that people were concerned about, you know, the president being beholden to the Pope when he was Catholic just a couple of generations ago, now we have the press talking about the Pope's wonderful ability to create this, open the door for this relationship between the United States and Cuba. This is all supposedly a wonderful thing. The press, the whole time the Pope came over to the United States, or he came to Cuba first, they said nothing about the fact that he wouldn't meet with the dissidents down there, that he propped up the tyrannical Castro regime, that the political situation in Cuba is as bad as it has ever been, and the Pope did nothing to try to undermine that. The press has said nothing about how the Pope's economic policies that he's advocating are disastrous, that they've actually bankrupted the Pope's home country of Argentina. Argentina used to be one of the leading economies in the world, and now it's a basket case precisely because they've been following the kind of economic policies that the Pope advocates. The press had nothing critical to say of this man, in spite of several things that they could have been critical of. And if it's just a matter of going along with his liberal policies, they didn't say anything about those policies where he's more conservative either. There was nothing critical of the fact that he is anti-abortion or anti-same-sex marriage or that type of thing. It's all positive. It's just really remarkable. I'll just throw it open to you guys. First of all, why do you suppose the press is so adoring of the Pope?
One thing we've talked about a fair bit here at the Trumpet is that there is a very strong left-wing bias across a whole lot of the press. And we talked about with Mr. Obama's election how much a lot of them supported Mr. Obama. And then we see again with the Pope, so much of what the Pope is trying to do matches exactly their agenda. And so they're very willing just to jump behind that, to support that, and then to even ignore the bits where it doesn't quite fit, because the Pope isn't really emphasizing those bits either. As long as the Pope keeps quiet about those, they'll keep quiet about those too, and just all try and push forward on those projects that they like.
Hold their nose on the same-sex marriage issue and talk about just how the Pope, we all need to be behind combating climate change because the Pope is as well.
Right, though, even with the same-sex marriage, the Pope kind of makes these ambiguous statements, and, you know, who am I to judge, as he famously said. And so he's very left it open so that the media and different media can just interpret bits whichever way they want and almost paint him whichever way they want to paint him.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that they would give the Pope that kind of latitude, whereas if you heard, say, I don't know, some political leader or some other conservative religious leader say, well, you know, we have to be careful about the way that we characterize this or something ambiguous, you wouldn't see them give him that kind of latitude. I thought it was interesting, actually, in that Time magazine article, it was saying how both the Raul Castro and President Obama were able to use the Pope's advocacy of this deal for political cover in Cuba. Basically, Castro is able to say, yeah, well, I'm still communist. I still have my same political views. We can open up this relationship with the United States because the Pope is behind it. And with President Obama, it was the same thing. He said, well, the Pope is behind it. So all of you who are concerned about being able to have this relationship with this repressive regime and that type of thing, you don't have to worry about it because, hey, the Pope is on board. So there's just a whole lot of respect given to this office that is just really remarkable. That hasn't been the case up until very recently.
I think it's exactly the same with a lot of these global warming and economic steps as well. So, for example, when he was speaking at the UN, he said solemn commitments are not enough. He talked about how our world demands, he called it a constant and perpetual will, is what he said the world needed to confront climate change and to confront problems with poverty. He talked about a will which is effective, practical, and constant. He talked about concrete steps and immediate measures. So following on from this, there are going to be steps within the UN or probably even within the United States or within Congress to combat climate change or to bring in more immigrants from Mexico or these socialist policies to have more spending. And it's going to be exactly as it was with Cuba. Mr. Obama will be saying, well, the Pope is behind it. He'll be quoting the speeches the Pope gave while he was over here, probably. And it would be exactly the same political coverage. And then a whole lot of his opponents, Republicans, there's a lot of them that are Catholic. And it's quite hard for them to then argue against the Pope.
What is the response among Europeans to, say, the liberal immigration policies that the Pope is advocating?
It's an interesting one because there are even bishops and I think there was even a cardinal, I could be wrong on that, that has said the Pope is wrong on this. So it's a it's mixed. I mean, it's just like it's mixed politically. I think it's mixed religiously. He doesn't seem like he's making as big deal of it in Europe as he was a couple of years ago.
Well, what has the Pope been saying about, say, the refugee crisis with respect to Europe specifically?
Well, he has been saying that Europe does need to do more to take in the persecuted and the immigrants. He was speaking to the European Parliament also since we've last spoken on this program, and he made some allusions to that there. He's told the Catholic Church, he said that every Catholic Church in Europe should take in two or three immigrants, which when you multiply across that from all of their churches, that's a pretty huge number. So he is pushing, but he's doing more of those quiet statements like all the Catholic Church had taken two or three rather than lecturing. Mm-hmm. But then there are bishops that have said, well, we don't necessarily agree with this. We need to look after our own people first and foremost. It's interesting. He's also said that Europe shouldn't discriminate, that it should take in Muslims as well as Christians. I'll be very interested to see if this remains the Catholic position on immigration. And just like we're seeing the politics change within Europe, I could well see the religious view of immigration changing within the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Brent.
Well, it's just more of a trend that we're looking at here, and it looks like Turkey is falling into the arms of Europe at the expense of Russia. We know that Russia is allied with Syria, and Turkey doesn't want Assad to keep on ruling there. And we had Russians violate Turkish airspace this week with their fighters in Syria. And then you had came out today that the Turkey's ascension to the EU, that's being brought to the table once again. They've been trying to do this since early 2000s, and it hasn't happened yet. And we probably believe that it won't happen, that they'll enter the EU. But we do believe that Turkey and the EU will become greater allies. So that's something to watch.
All right. Thanks very much. We'll turn now to Richard.
I'd like to talk about a really fantastic article we have from Stratfor on the Trumpet Weekly called The Next Phase of European Power Politics. It's definitely worth going in and reading, but in this article, Stratfor talks about a big change within Europe because throughout most of history, you have multiple competing powers within Europe. Recently, you had kind of two powers, France and Germany, dominating Europe. Now, we have a big change. It's Germany alone dominating Europe. They talked about how Germany was dictating to the rest of the continent during the Euro crisis. And then we've seen that again on immigration. It says here, just like the negotiations with Athens, Berlin suddenly found itself making public threats to its EU partners. And this was on taking on migrants. And it talks about how it worked. The German threats forced countries like Poland to change their view, to say that they would take more migrants in. And they write, these developments are noteworthy because they suggest a change in Germany's behavior. If Germany decides it's time for more unilateral leadership in Europe, it will open a new era in the continent's balance of power.
Powerful stuff. Thank you very much. We'll go now to Anthony.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe stirred controversy when he came up with the slogan that Erika's Japan's wartime propaganda. The slogan is for his economic policies. He wants Japan's economy to expand five times, and he also wants to put a cap on Japan's population because right now it's shrinking. Right now it's at 126 million. It's shrinking, and he wants to cap it at 100 million.
You mean prevent it from going below 100 million?
Yes. So he has a slogan that says, society in which all 100 million people can be active. But the problem with that is that Japan's wartime officials have used statements similar to that when they said 100 million civilians should come and join in the war, the Koreans, the Taiwanese, to die rather than to accept defeat in World War II. So it's pretty obvious that he was trying to make a connection with that. And it's not surprising because this prime minister has been pushing for Japan to militarize. And that's essentially a sign of how weak the United States has been, because the United States has promised to provide Japan's military needs so that Japan doesn't need to militarize. And it also just shows how the whole region is going to militarize and join up with the Russians and the Chinese.
Thank you, Anthony. On the Anglo-American front, I wanted to talk about the number of sanctuary cities in the United States. It has grown to more than 340, according to a report released by the Center of Immigration Studies. These are cities that refuse to cooperate with federal deportation requests. And last year, these cities shielded on average 1,000 immigrants a month from deportation. So more than 2,000 of those who've been released have already been arrested for still more crimes, including murders and brutal assaults. Obviously, this last summer, there was the very high-profile case of Catherine Steinle, who was shot and killed in San Francisco by a released illegal immigrant in that sanctuary city. But U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said that from January to June of this year, cities released 16,000 illegal immigrants that Homeland Security was seeking. So this is a tremendous display of lawlessness on the part of these cities. And You know, we just had all of the lectures from the left about Kim Davis and how she was lawless and she needed to follow through with her oath of office in marrying these same-sex couples in Kentucky. All of a sudden, they were very concerned about the rule of law, this foundational principle of the United States. But where is the outrage when it comes to this act of lawlessness? And there are so many like it that are committed by those on the left. It's a very selective outrage when it comes to the enforcement of the rule of law. This is a tremendous example of just how lawless the United States has become in ways that are extremely destructive to this country. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition, and we encourage you to get this very high quality publication. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. We're also on Facebook and Google Plus if you just search for Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank our panel, Anthony Chabotterway, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Dale Carnegie. Feeling sorry for yourself and your present condition is not only a waste of energy, but the worst habit you could possibly have. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.